Let's turn to Genesis chapter 37 and we will pick up where we left off last week. In chapter 37, we went through the first 11 verses last week, and what we saw there was that Joseph was the, not the youngest, but the next to youngest son of Jacob, and he was Jacob's favorite. And Jacob apparently, and really an act of, well, certainly not an act of wisdom, decided to broadcast that, and basically, I'm sure his intent was not to rub it in, but he gave him a multicolored jacket that none of the other brothers got, just Joseph. And then God gives Joseph two dreams, and in the dreams they communicate a couple of things, that ultimately he would be the head of this family, and that his brothers would bow down to him one day, and ultimately that even his father and his mother and his brothers would end up bowing down to him. He was going to become the chief someday. That's all there was to it. God gave him those dreams because God knew that he would need those dreams for the trials that he was about to go in. And there is always a process that occurs when God gives us vision of what he has in mind for our lives, and he gives us his dreams in terms of what is going to happen as it relates to our lives, something he plants in our hearts. There is always, between the time that he gives these things to us and the time that they are come to full fruition, actually happen, there is a time always of preparation. Always a time of preparation. You and I as Christians are always being prepared. We are being prepared for heaven. We are being prepared to be around that throne of God. We're being prepared as the bride of Christ, and we are also being prepared as it relates to what God has called us to in terms of what it is his ministry in these last days. So there is always going to be preparation. And Joseph is now going to head into a 13-year period of preparation. Now, that can make your heart sink, especially if you're in the middle of a trial right now. But this guy is ultimately going to become, in one hour, he is going to go from the pit of an Egyptian prison to becoming the second most powerful man on the face of the planet. He was not ready for it at 17. He didn't have the character for it. Wasn't in place yet. He had the character in place to be a 17-year-old. He had the character in place for this and for that, but not for what God had called him to yet. And so there's preparation. There's preparation in our life. The preparation always centers on one thing, and that is godly character. And when God puts us through the trials, the tribulation, the different things that we go through in preparation for greater and greater and greater fruitfulness in our lives, always be sure what he is striving for, what he is moving towards, is greater character in our lives. He's not waiting to put us in the position that he's ultimately going to put us in until we're rich. He's not waiting until we become secure and independently wealthy so that we can then go and do what it is. He's waiting and developing character. He's not waiting until I've developed my pastoral library and then I can head into the ministry. These things he can add into our lives in a moment. They mean nothing to him. It's nothing to him to add these things in a second in time. But character takes time. Character takes time. And that's what he's working. He gives the dream. Then he begins the preparation. And the preparation involves the development of character. When we are in trials, it is very wise to say to the Lord, "What character are you developing in me, Lord?" God doesn't put us in trials just to put us in trials. Now, Dan Konchak hasn't been in a trial for a while. How'd I miss him? Is it time for a trial? No. There's a reason in every trial, and it relates to character. What kind of character? Christ-likeness. Godly character. That's the character that he's bringing out in our lives. And the same thing that Joseph went through, every single one of us as children of God are going to go through. There is no escaping it because there's no fruitfulness, there's no Christ-likeness any other way. And so this is why I think, along with the book of Job, this is one of the most encouraging passages in all of the Bible when we are in trials. Because when we are in trials, typically the first thing I lose is perspective. I don't know what's going on. Doesn't make any sense to me. And so isn't it nice to be able to get a bird's eye view of how God works through the testimony of Joseph so that we can understand how he works and why he works. And so this is what it is that is going on. It's character that is important to God. And then his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. Now, the last time they were in Shechem, it was a bad scene. They slaughtered the whole city. And Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem?" He's no doubt concerned about them and how long they've been gone, and maybe some mischief has come their way because of their history related to the city. And he said, "Maybe your brothers are feeding the flock there in Shechem. Come, I will send you to them." And so he said to him, Joseph did, here I am, send me. And then he said to him, "Please go and see if it's well with your brothers and well with the flocks, and bring back word to me." And so he sent him out of the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem, 50 miles, probably about a two-day journey. Now a certain man found him, and there Joseph was, wandering in the field, obviously lost and looking for something. And the man asked him, saying, "What are you seeking?" And so he said, "I am seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they're feeding their flocks." The man said, "They have departed from here, for I heard them say, 'Let's go down to Dothan.'" And so Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan, which is about 20 miles. Now, when they saw him afar off, easily recognized by his brightly colored coat that he no doubt wore, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. They weren't going to put him in a headlock and give him a rabbit burn on the top of his head or some typical older brother thing, or, you know, put ice down his diaper or something like that. I mean, they wanted to kill this guy. Pretty intense scene. Pretty intense household. And they said to one another, "Look, this dreamer is coming." That was the sore spot, the dream, that showed them bowing down to Joseph. "Come, therefore, and let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say some wild beast has devoured him. And we shall see, you know, what will become of his dreams. That'll put the end of his dreams. We'll just kill the guy, throw him in a pit, and his dreams won't come true." But Reuben heard it, the oldest, and he delivered him out of their hands by saying, "Let's not kill him." And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood, but cast him into this pit," really in a broken cistern, "which is in the wilderness, and don't lay a hand on him." And he said this in order that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father. And so it came to pass, when Joseph had come to his brothers, that the first thing they did was they stripped him of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. And they took him and they cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty and there was no water in it, and they sat down to eat a meal. So they've taken this guy and they've thrown him in there and they want to kill him and they know they're not supposed, you know, they're trying to devise how in the world should we deal with him other than killing him, and they throw him down into the pit. Now in chapter, later on in chapter 42 of this book of Genesis, we find out a little bit more about what Joseph was doing while he was in the pit. And what he was doing was something like this. "Help, please, let me out, let me out." He is pleading with them for his life. And he's begging them, anguish of soul he's pleading from, it tells us, that they would spare his life. He knows he is in deep, deep trouble with these guys. And so they sit down and they eat their lunch, a fairly hard-hearted group, I would say. And they lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead, which was a very fertile plateau on the east side of the Jordan River in Galilee. And so the Ishmaelites were doing very well, involved in trade, and they came with their camels bearing spices and balm and myrrh, and they were on their way to carry them down to Judah. And so, to Egypt, rather. And so Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? We don't make any money off of that. Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh." And his brothers listened. And then the Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. Now you can imagine this guy. He is just running an errand for dad. You put yourself in his shoes. He just was going to go and make sure everyone was doing all right. And now here he is pleading for his life, and all of a sudden now he's a part of a caravan, sold as a slave, and he's on his way to Egypt. And this caravan that comes along doesn't just happen to come along. God sends the caravan. And yet, in Joseph's mind, it has to be, "I'm in this pit. This is a ridiculous thing for me to be in. It can't get any worse than this. Surely they're going to let me out. It's a big practical joke." And the next thing is, he finds himself on the way to Egypt, and it looks like everything is completely out of control. Looks like his dream is foolishness, headed towards Egypt. And yet God is in it. God is totally 100% in it. He sent the caravan to get this man to Egypt, because he wants him in Egypt, because Egypt is where he's going to teach him the lessons that he needs to be taught. There are no accidents in our lives. I like to think there are. And I like to think that some of the things that come into my life that look especially tragic or especially difficult, or that there's no way God is going to work this together for good, that this puts, you know, that it can be put into some kind of a category that, you know, this will be the one that he won't be able to work together for good. And yet, the testimony of our life is always, always, by the time we get out of the trial, to realize that he just smothered it in his grace, and he was absolutely faithful, and he did work good out of it. And so this situation just gets worse and worse and worse, but it's by design, because God is digging deeper and deeper and deeper in this man's life. And he is trying to develop character here in Joseph's life, and he is developing it through a pretty tough family. Pretty tough upbringing, I'd say. Sounds like a pretty dysfunctional family to me. This whole thing seems pretty hard on his inner child, if you ask me. And I'm not just taking a cheap shot. Got to examine these things. These are the things we're being inundated with. He's been raised with 10 cold-blooded murderers and thieves. That's his family. That's his family. His dad has a tendency to drift back into being a con man, a heel catcher, and quite an embarrassment every time he does. And his mom's dead, but his dad still has another wife and some concubines. And here he is in the midst of this kind of a family, in the violence of the family, the hatred of the entire family except for his dad towards him. And now when you think it can't get any worse, he loses the one family he has. He's gone at 17, taken away, stolen away. And so he's raised in the midst of tremendous strife, tremendous difficulties. And I categorically reject the idea that God is not big enough to overwhelm our childhoods and to work it together for good. There were times when I was growing up that I stayed awake all night because I was afraid that somebody in the household would murder us before the night was over. And I could go on for hours and tell you stories. And it doesn't work against you. Because what it develops in our lives is a character and at least a compassion that would not be there any other way. But if somebody wants to come to me and wants to begin to make me to feel sorry for myself or to spend all of my life back there in that whole scene and trying to figure the whole thing out, I can't figure the whole thing out. And I don't know why all of it happened. All I know is that it brings forth fruit today. And you and I would not be who we are, and even as limitedly fruitful as we are, without the difficult things that were a part of our lives. And so we can go into all of the madness of trying to search all of it out and all, but the bottom line is he who he is? And can he and will he work it together for good? However horrific it might be, yes, he can. Yes, he can. And you have character in your life that would not be there otherwise. Just wouldn't be there. It's not working against you. It's all part of the preparation. And we watch in our lives. If we've walked with the Lord for longer than 2 weeks, and especially the longer we walk with the Lord, we see his hand in our life before we ever surrender to him. We see his grace and how he was working all along. His fingerprints are everywhere. And so was the case in Joseph's life. So was the case. Character being developed in this way. And so he's taken now into Egypt. And Reuben returned to the pit. Apparently he had left for some time while all of this was going on. And Joseph was not in the pit, and he tore his clothes. He didn't know what had happened to him. And he returned to his brothers and said, "The lad is no more, where shall I go? I'm the oldest brother. I'm responsible for him. Where is he gone? What are we going to do?" And so now they've got to come up with some kind of a plan here to report to Jacob what's happened to his son. And so they took Joseph's tunic and they killed a kid of the goats and dipped the tunic in the blood. And they sent the tunic of many colors and they brought it to their father and said, "We found this. Do you know whether it's your son's tunic or not?" This is cruel beyond description. You don't do anything harder to a parent than this. There is nothing you can do harder to a parent than this. And he recognized it and he said, "It is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Without a doubt, Joseph is torn to pieces." And Jacob tore his clothes and he put sackcloth on his waist and he mourned for his son many days. And all the sons, I mean, what hard-heartedness. This is a cruel group. And all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him. And he refused to be comforted, and he said to them, "For I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning." And thus his father wept for him. Now the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. And so now begins a period of 22 years that is going to go by before Joseph ever sees his father again. 22 years this is going to go on, this trial. It is interesting here as you look at this, is the Midianites have no use for him. They sell him immediately in Egypt to Potiphar. And the word officer of Pharaoh, their officer, it has the meaning of eunuch. Now, he might have been a eunuch or he might not have been a eunuch, but it can be either way. But he might have been a eunuch, and we don't know. The captain of the guard literally means the captain of the slaughterers. This guy was the head of the executioners there in Pharaoh's court. He's the guy that killed the people that, or headed up the guys that killed the people who went against Pharaoh. So he's heading into, you know, pretty tough scene here too, actually. And it came to pass at that time that Judah departed from his brothers, and he visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira, and he's going to become a friend of Hira. And Judah, having left his other brothers, saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. And he married her and went into her, and she conceived and bore a son and called his name Ur, which means watcher. He's going to have three children with this Canaanite woman, and the first one he names with a Hebrew name. The other two are named with Canaanite names. And so he declines quickly once he begins to mix with the Canaanites. It's a lot easier to pull someone down than it is to pull them up. And so he calls the first one Ur, which means watcher. And she conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan, which means strong. And she conceived yet again and bore a son and called his name Shelah, which was at Chezib where when she bore him. He was at Chezib when she bore him. And then Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn. So some time is going by here, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord killed him. And Judah said to Onan, "Go in to your brother's wife and marry her and raise up an heir to your brother." Now, apparently, this is already a practice. Later, it will become a part of the law of Moses. But already a practice where if a brother marries a wife and he dies before there is a son conceived as a result of the marriage, then the next brother was to go into her until she conceived and bore a son. And the reason is because in that culture, and actually in many cultures today, apart from Western civilization, your security network, your security system, your social security was the family unit. It was not government. It was the family unit. And for you to be married and your husband to die in a very competitive environment as it related to husbands, it was very difficult for you to remarry, for someone to take an interest in you and remarry you. It's quite different today in our culture. And so here you were now, a woman who is a widow with no children, and you were in that culture dependent upon having children, having sons, who would then marry and have children and take care of you in your old age. They represented a security. And for a woman to lose her husband and to be not only a widow but to be without any children was to immediately go down to the level of a beggar. There was no telling. Her very survival was in danger. And so there was this means of assuring that she would at least have one son to continue the family, and that's the way that it worked. And again, later it would become a part of the law of Moses. Here it is practiced even before the law. And so Judah said, "Go into her, and your brother's wife, marry her, raise up an heir to your brother," and then he would be free to go off and marry who it is that he wanted. But Onan knew that the heir would not be his. And what he's going to do here displeases God. And what he does is wrong, and his attitude is wrong in it, because he's not going to get to receive the son. Children represented wealth. They represented potential for prosperity. And so here he is. He's going to raise up a son, but he's not going to get any of the benefits of this son. He doesn't like it. He's completely dominated by selfishness, and he has no concern for her. Doesn't care. I don't care if you become a beggar. I don't care if you do die. I don't want anything to do with anything that I'm not going to come out on top as it relates to. And that's his attitude. So he knew that the child would not be his, and it came to pass that he went into his brother's wife, that when he did, that he omitted on the ground lest he should give an heir to his brother. And the thing that he did displeased the Lord, and therefore the Lord killed him also. And Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, "Remain a widow in your father's house till my son Shelah is grown." Now he apparently is quite a bit younger than the older brothers there. So he says, "You go home, let them take care of your support, and then when my youngest son is old enough to go in unto you, then we'll go ahead and do that." But he's not in a position to right now. And for he said, lest he also die as his brothers did. And Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house. Now, in the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died. So Judah now becomes a widower. And Judah was comforted, and he went up to his sheep shears at Timnah, he and his friend Hira, the Adullamite. And it was told Tamar, saying, look, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep. He's heading off. And so she took off her widow's garments, covered herself with a veil, and wrapped herself, and she sat in an open place which was on the way to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah was grown, and she was not given to him as wife. In other words, Judah has no intention of giving his son to this woman. So she takes things into her own hands and dresses up as a harlot and sits on the way. And when Judah saw her, he thought that she was a harlot because she had covered her face. And then he turned to her by the way and said, please let me come in to you, for he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. And so she said, what will you give me that you may come in to me? And he said, the bartering, I will send you a young goat from the flock. And she said, will you give me a pledge till you send it? All the guys say that. I want something that tells me you're going to bring a goat back. And then he said, well, what pledge shall I give you? And so she said, your signet and cord and your staff. The signet was a seal that was used to mark your property, and apparently he had a cord that he used to wrap it around his arm or to hold it to his body in some way. And so your signet and your cord and your staff that is in your hand. And then he gave them to her, went into her, and she conceived by him. And so she arose, went away, laid aside her veil, and put on the garments of widowhood. Now, you're reading along in Genesis, and there seems to be some kind of thought progression involved until this chapter. It's like, what happened to Joseph? What do you got to read all this raunchy stuff for? Did somebody like get a page mixed up here and Moses and the thing? Well, how did that slip in? What in the world is it? Why would that be there? I remember reading this. I thought, what does this have to do with anything? But there is a reason. And what God is communicating, he is showing us, as Judah leaves his family, he becomes absorbed by the world. And God knows that every single member of that family would ultimately do the same thing unless God did something. They were in danger of being absorbed by the world before they ever became what God had intended for them to become, and before he ever got to bless the entire world through them. And so he takes and he shows us what would have happened to this family if he had not begun to do what he was doing through Joseph. Because it is through Joseph that he's going to keep this family together, and he's going to bring them into Egypt, and they are going to go from being just a very large family to becoming a nation. And that's what they needed. They needed a time and a place of being separated from the world so that the uniqueness of their identity would not be lost. Where in the world could that happen in the day of Joseph? Egypt only. Because the Egyptians were in a very protracted period of greatness. And the Egyptians looked down on everyone else in the civilized world at that time. They would no more have something to do with the Hebrew than, you know, whatever. You finish the sentence. They just wouldn't have anything to do with them. And so Egypt was the place for them to go in. The Egyptians would look at them and say, these are stinking Hebrews. I mean, they would say the same thing about an Irishman. They'd say, these are stinking Irishmen. I mean, it wasn't just Hebrews. It was anybody that wasn't them. And so they could go in there and God would be able to maintain their identity. And so here he gives us a glimpse at how critical was the timing, how important and vitally important for the whole history of mankind what it was that he was doing in Joseph's life. You and I have no idea how big the picture is as it relates to our lives. We have no idea how big the picture is as it relates to the body of Christ in these days. And so that's why this is here. We're getting a glimpse at this. We're getting a glimpse at the wisdom of God here. And Judah sent the young goat, verse 20, by the hand of his friend, the Adullamite, to receive his pledge from the woman's hand, but he did not find her. And then he asked the men of that place, saying, "Where is the harlot who was openly by the roadside?" And they said, "There was no harlot in this place. This isn't where harlots hang out, sir." And he returned to Judah and said, I can't find her. Also, the men of the place says there was no harlot in this place. And then Judah said, let her take them for herself, the stuff that I left her, lest we be shamed. I mean, I tried to give her what, you know, her price was. For I sent this young goat, and you have not found her. And it came to pass about 3 months later that Judah was told, saying, "Tamar, your daughter-in-law has played the harlot, and furthermore, she is with child by harlotry." And Judah said, "Bring her out and let her be burned. Flame on." I mean, he's mad. She's disgraced the whole family, this harlotry and everything. Let's get the fires going and burn her. Oh, the little hypocrite. And again, isn't it amazing how terrible my sin looks on you? Oh, it looks okay on me. Oh, there are reasons for why I'm involved in it and these kinds of things. But boy, it looks bad on you, and I'm just intolerant of it in you. We have to be very careful. Sometimes it is a good thing for us to notice what we are most angry about and what we see the most quickly in other people's lives in terms of their failings. Because very often we recognize it so quickly because we are so familiar with it in our own lives. And so he's ready to burn her. But she is a smart woman. And when she was brought out, she sent to her father-in-law, saying, "By the man to whom these belong, I am with child." And she said, "Please determine whose these are, the signet and cord and staff." And so Judah acknowledged them and said, "She has been more righteous than I, because I did not give her to Shelah my son, and he never knew her again." Now it came to pass at the time for giving birth that, behold, twins were in her womb. And so it was when she was giving birth that the one put out his hand, and the midwife took a scarlet thread and bound it on his hand, saying, "This one came out first." This was apparently very important. And then it happened, as he drew back his hand, that his brother came out unexpectedly. And she said, "How did you break through? This breach be upon you." And therefore they called his name Perez, which means breaking through. I'm telling you, whatever happened from that birth canal on, you're going to be named by it. Now the interesting thing here is that Jesus, the Messiah, the second reason that this chapter is here is to allow us to trace the lineage of Messiah. And Jesus, the Messiah, Jacob is going to prophesy at the end of Genesis that he would come through Judah. And not only would he come through Judah, but he would come through Perez here. This is the child. This was a child that was part of the lineage of Jesus. This Tamar that played the harlot. And Perez is a part of both Joseph's lineage and Mary's lineage, both the physical lineage and the legal lineage of Jesus. It's interesting that in the genealogy that's listed there in Matthew, there are four women who are listed, only four women listed in that genealogy. And the four women that are listed is first Tamar, who has some questionable background in this particular chapter. Then Rahab, who was a harlot in Jericho. And then Bathsheba, who was, it was a rather uncomfortable scene, though no fault of her own as it related to the history of Israel with David. And finally, there was Ruth the Moabitess. There's hardly a blue blood in the whole group. He really did identify with sinners. He really did. And afterwards, his brother came out who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and his name was called Zerah, the guy who snoozed and loosed. Now, it means rising. I don't know why they got that out. Chapter 39. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, the officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. And the Lord was with Joseph, and that's all that matters. That's all that matters. Is it not how easy the situation I'm in is, or how difficult the situation is? Am I in this situation with Him? And He was. He was right in the center of God's will. And it was a difficult circumstance and situation that He was in. But God was with Him. The Lord was with Joseph. And He was a successful man. And He was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And so Joseph was a successful man. He's a slave. He's a butler. Now, given today's economy, I know that a butler looks a fairly attractive job. Any job looks attractive. Butler, what kind of benefits can we get on that? Do you include medical? Man, is medical coverage going out? I don't want to get on that. And here he is. I mean, he has gone from the top to the bottom so quickly, and yet God says he's a successful man. Why? What's the definition of success? Doing what God has called me to do today. That's a successful man. Whether he's got 2 cents in his pocket or $1 million in his pocket, that's a successful man. Because that's the man who ultimately hears, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant, enter into the joy of the Lord." And no life that does not hear those words can be considered a successful life. He is successful. He is successful. And yet, anybody who would come along and say, listen, if he were to go up to anyone there in the palace there and say, "Hi, I'm a successful man," they'd laugh him to scorn. They'd laugh him to scorn. You're nothing. You're a nobody. You're an insignificant. I'll remember that. I'm going to be second in the world in 13 years. By the time God works that character in his life, he doesn't care to remember. Now, personally, for me, Potiphar's wife would have had a tough time by the time I became second to only Pharaoh in Egypt. I'd call her on the carpet. Do you remember? Well, we'll get to that in a moment. You're getting me ahead of myself here. And he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian, doing what God had called him to do, and his master saw that the Lord was with him. Successful again. Why? Because it was apparent in his life that God was working in his life. People were seeing that. That's the most important thing. And that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. He wasn't where he wanted to be at all there in Egypt, but he worked hard there in Egypt. And Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. And then he made him overseer of his house, and all that he had put in and all that he had he put in his hand. And so it was from the time that he had made him overseer of his house and all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in the house and in the field. And so he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he didn't know what he had except for the bread that Joseph served him that day. And Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. Here God is developing character in Joseph's life in a very, very interesting way in these first six verses. He develops character in his life by making him a slave in Egypt, by putting him in an unjust work situation. He's being taken advantage of, and he's there working for peanuts, for nothing. Everything he touches turns to gold by the grace of God, and he's making minimum wage, less than minimum wage. And it seems like the most unfair situation of all. And he's placed where he desperately doesn't want to be. He doesn't want to be a servant there in Egypt. He doesn't want to be in Egypt at all. But it's out of his control. We can find ourselves in the same situations where God can put us in places, and there we are, such and such an age or whatever it might be. And we have all of these degrees and all of this background and all of this expertise, and here I am working for minimum wage. I'm a slave. I'm doing something that's completely non-technical, something that's way below my expertise and my ability. And they're taking advantage of me. And all of the money that's being made here in this place is being made because of what it is that I'm doing, and none of it's getting passed on to me. And you can get very bitter over situations like that. Very angry. And here I am, stuck in this job, stuck in this place. It's the last place in the world I want to be, and yet I have no control to change it. It looks like it's all working against me, except it's working character in my life. Character in my life. And so you work there for 10 years, or you work there for 6 months, or however many years it might be. You say, look at all the money I lost. I could have been making this over here, and I just don't have anything like that. It's all a big waste. God can give you $1 million in a day once he's been able to work the character that he wants to work into our lives. That was the whole issue. And oftentimes, many, many times, history of this church, I've had men come to me, and they're perhaps coming out of prison, or they're coming out of some difficult situation, or they've lived this life of sin and they have no reputation left, and the horrible consequences following them or whatever, and now they want to get their life straight and they're walking with the Lord and all, and the only thing that they can land right now is in their words typically, is this minimum wage job. And I mean, they drive me for that for something an hour. And I mean, they work me hard and everything, and it's not fair, it's not right, and what's going on here? And always what I say is this: the great treasure of what is happening in your life, the great wage that you're receiving right now, is not in dollars and cents, it is in character. It's what you're learning between you and God. And it's what you're willing to do between you and God, even when, and working with all of your might, when you should be getting paid maybe 5 times more for what it is that you're doing. But you do it with all of your might. Why? Because you're a man of character and you're serving the Lord there. And then when I learn the lessons of character in that place, it's nothing for him to then move me out of that place if he desires, if he has other plans. And so these situations that seem so working against us, they're not working against us. And God uses this very kind of situation to work here in Joseph's life. Now, notice, please, at the end of verse 6, it says, "And Joseph was handsome in form and appearance." Can I just get a show of hands for those of you who consider yourself handsome in form and appearance? Quick show of hands. I thought so. What this means is the guy was just a flat-out hunk. It means that he was one very attractive man. He was not only good-looking in terms of face and all of that, but he was built. He was just what women dream of. And the point is this. If you are a man or a woman, and you are of this caliber, handsome in form and appearance, please, I don't know what advantage it is for you to be that, but I know there are disadvantages for you from this situation that God brings out, and that is you will gather and towards yourself undue attention that is not always good. And if you know that God has blessed you that way, you must be very much on guard as it relates to the type of temptation that is going to come Joseph's way right now. Now, nobody would admit to being that or anything, but you, those of you who are in that category, I suppose you know by the regularity that you get hit on that there must be something to it. But very important account, and important for the rest of us too. "Now it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph." Uh-oh. "And she said, lie with me." Here is Joseph, 17 years old. That's a big temptation for a 17-year-old or a 71-year-old. He's this servant, he's this slave in this other country. He has no position of power at all. He's a very young man, a very attractive man. She is no doubt very attractive. These men did not marry unattractive wives. You were in government and held those positions. She is also, no doubt, his social superior, an intimidating kind of thing for a young man. And she has the power to make life absolutely miserable for him if he refuses her or embarrasses her in this situation, if he doesn't cooperate. And she tries to seduce him, and she says, "I am available to you, and I want you." Now, you think about that kind of a trial or that kind of a temptation for Joseph. Just for a moment, you think about that. Young, the desires of a 17-year-old. She has great, great power. He's in another country. Who would know? And yet he says no to the temptation. Before we even get into the temptation, I think we need to notice one thing. This temptation comes his way right out of the blue. He's not looking for it. He's not asking for this. He's just doing his job. And he has no sense of what's going on in her mind and what it is that she's devising and the plan that she's foists upon him. He's just going about his business, and this trial comes just like that. All of the sudden, in one second, this is presented to him. And this is why it is so important in our daily walk with Christ that we do not live near the edge of temptation. And sometimes a temptation or just a blast from the enemy, and I have no doubt that that's what's going on here. He is trying to derail God's plan. He sees what's happening. He understands what's happening here. He knows what's going on. And so he comes in, and if God is working character in our lives, he's aware of it more than anyone, certainly more aware of it than we are aware of it, and he's going to oppose it, and he opposes it with this kind of temptation and other kinds of temptation. And so here this thing comes like a wind, boom, and it hits him, and he's ready for it. He's ready for it. And so often, the body of Christ, a person will, during the times of like a long kind of period of no ups and downs in terms of temptation, we can begin to drift right towards the edge of the cliff as it relates to what is our weak area, and we all have a weak area. And then when the wind blows down of temptation, if we're right on the edge, there's nothing to hold us, and we go over the edge in the temptation. The people who stand are the ones who walk like Joseph, and that is, he's way away from the edge. And it may hit him, and he may be buckled with surprise for a moment related to it, but he's a long way from the edge. And Satan is very good at lulling us to sleep, and then all of a sudden just blasting loose on us when he spots us near that edge, that cliff. Very, very important. Very, very important to understand. And so he says to her in verse 8, but he refused and said to his master's wife, look, my master does not know what is with me in the house, and he has committed all that he has into my hand. And there's no one greater in this house than me, nor has he kept back anything from me, but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this wickedness and sin against God? And so it was as she spoke to Joseph day by day that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. Joseph says no to this temptation. And it's interesting how he deals with this temptation to me. He doesn't deal with it in some kind of hyper-emotional thing. Ha, 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 kind of thing. He doesn't head into some, you know, kind of crazed deal of dealing with this temptation that comes his way at all. Not dominated by his feelings, his emotions, or anything, but he deals with it on the basis of his mind. He deals with it as just an act of his will. And as an act of his will, he says to her, no. And so can we adopt a just say no program as it relates to sin? Dealing with temptation? We can, but it won't be nearly as effective as we see it operating here, because Joseph not only says no, but he says no for good reason. He has reasons that he says no. There's a reason that he turns her down. And when temptation comes our way, we can't be standing there and looking for a reason to say no. And temptation comes my way, I can't say, okay, here's, I have to say no, or I should say no, or what did my, you know, Sunday school teacher tell me to do here in this situation, and I can attempt to put on Saul's armor, or I can attempt to preach, you know, the Jesus that Paul preaches, or this kind of thing, and I'll just get wiped out, I'll get whipped. He says no, but he says no for a reason, and he says no for good reasons. And he says no for reasons that he had worked out in his heart and mind long before the temptation ever hit. He was ready for it. He was ready for it. He wasn't trying to formulate reasons for saying no to this woman during temptation. Ever tried to do that? There's a good reason. I should. Okay. Oh boy, Satan's too slick for that. And our flesh is too weak for that. to be in the middle of a scene and trying to figure out what I should do and why I should do it. It is either something that is there in my life that a no comes from, or I'm in deep, deep trouble. And he has three reasons that he says no to this woman. And these three reasons protect him in his time of temptation. And the first reason that he gives, he says no because it wouldn't be right to do this to another human being. It wouldn't be right to do this to your husband. Loving his neighbor as himself. Love for his neighbor as himself. Wouldn't be right. And he realizes that his sin would affect others, and before he does it, he realizes that there would be consequences to this. You think about that. If I have that anchored in my heart, if the greatest and most handsome hunk of a man out of the 5.2 billion people on planet Earth were to come to you and say, "Here I am, and I love you." Or some bombshell. I mean, everything that your fantasy would come and make herself available to you. If I have thought ahead of time of the consequences that sexual immorality would bring into my life, that adultery would bring into my life, it makes it much easier to say no, because it will create an awful lot more problems for a long period of time than a few moments of pleasure will ever bring. It is important to count the cost and to think about what is going to happen based upon my decision here. And so he did. He did. He says, in effect, "I don't want to hurt this man. I don't want to violate his trust. You're his wife. I'm not going to do this to him." And he's looking out for his neighbor. The second reason that he doesn't do this is in verse 9 there, where he says, "This is great wickedness. This is wrong." And he is personally, genuinely appalled at the sin. "What you are asking me to do is great wickedness." Three cheers for innocence. I was talking with a brother last week on Sunday morning, and he was talking about things that we don't hear about anymore. One of the things that people don't do anymore, you never see them do it on TV, we hardly see them ever do it in any circumstances, is you never see people blush anymore. And there's no blushing in our culture. And blushing is a good thing, a real embarrassment over this and having seen it and being exposed to it and this coming my way. There's a loss of innocence. It's not a good thing. It's not a good thing. And so here he is. He's innocent, and he realizes this is great wickedness, and it is good to view sin as great wickedness. I would say this. That means for me to have that attitude, and don't dismiss me as a legalist on this issue, but that means, I would say conservatively, 80% of entertainment is just unallowable for me as a Christian. What comes out on 8-track and... just kidding. Some of the older guys say, "Oh no, he's flashing back. He's going to talk about albums next." But about 80% of what's there in terms of television and movies and the music and the different things, that Parental Guidance magazine that comes out on Focus on the Family, the latest one had a review of Pyros for Porno, their new album, what that's all about. And And then Janet Jackson's new album. And the whole thing is full of sex and oral sex. And I mean, just unbelievable orgasms being, you know, simulated, I assume, all the way through the whole thing. And all, I cannot listen to that and then consider sin to be great wickedness. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man sows, that shall he also reap. And I will not be in Joseph's position of saying, that is wickedness if that is my steady diet. It won't happen. It simply won't happen. I will be right here. And so here he is. It's wickedness. It's defined as wickedness. And it's important to take and identify sexual immorality as wickedness. It's wrong and it's wicked, along with all of the other different types of things. And so here he takes, and how important it was for him to view sin as sin and sin as great wickedness. It was critical for him to stand. He needed that to stand. We need that to stand. The final reason that he gives is that he recognizes that it would hurt God. There at the end of verse 9, how can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? After all he's done for me, he's been faithful. He knew God was being faithful. And he says, in light of who he is, I don't want to hurt God as his child. I realize that God is involved in my life. He's with me. He's present. He sees. He has plans. All of these things. And it is all of this, these words that he says, wonderful words there in verse 9. How can I? And it wasn't a thing of, well, let's see now, what would be the profound Christian thing to say as it related to this temptation so that God could take and use that in his writing of the book of Genesis and that I would come across as really a spiritual kind of guy. When this thing comes out, it's like, how can I? I mean, it jumps out. It's who he is. It's his character. It's what's planted in there. It wasn't some kind of thing that he worked out. How could I? It leaps out of him, and it leaps out of him because his heart is prepared, and it comes from the knowledge that I am different. I am different. I am different as a child of God. And yes, it may appeal to me, but I'm different as a child of God. And that's what it comes forth from. We learn from Joseph a very important lesson. You can do it. At 17, you can say no. At 21, I can say no. At 23, I can say no. At 30, at 40, at 50, at 60, at 70, I can say no. I can resist. I can stay pure. And sometimes you need to hear that, because you don't hear that from anyone but God. And we are inundated with information that tells us the opposite. And now we see in recent newspapers, and I'm going a little longer, I'm aware of it, that in terms of the positions of health services in the United States of America on a federal level, they're going to change their positions as it relates to softening their stand as it relates to abstinence. Going to move away from that and move more and more and more towards the condoms and towards all of this. And we need to hear this message of Joseph that you can stand, you can stay pure. For those of you who are younger, you must understand, because your life depends on it, your life depends upon it, that the adults who are in the positions of power that be, they are not looking out for you. They are not looking out for you. Only God is looking out for you. And they, dominated by their own flesh and their own lack of self-control and their own thinkings, take and they foist all of these kinds of things on you, and they are laying you by the day on the altar of sexual immorality, the god of Molech. That's where you're being laid, on the altar of the god of lust. And if they don't understand that the devil is real, and if they don't understand that God is real, and if they don't understand that there is light and there is dark and there is a warfare that's going on and there is a scene that is happening bigger than anything they can imagine, and that they are just tools of the enemy, then at least you understand it. You understand it. Because in your day, your very life depends on making the right choice. Your very life depends upon it. Don't look, you don't want to hit something and pick up something that you don't want to pick up and then look back and say, I wish I would have listened to God. I wish I wouldn't have believed them. In this day, in this age, in this wickedness, you've got to look out for yourself. And that means looking to God and obeying His Word. He's the only one on the face of this planet on this Sunday night in 1993 who knows what in the world he's talking about. And we'll be done in a moment here. Where am I got my time here? They say that people won't abstain. I don't believe them for a moment. They will abstain. People will once again abstain. But the question is, what generation is going to be sacrificed to the sexually transmitted diseases of this age? How many of your generation will die of AIDS? It's your generation. It's your generation that's being thrown on the altar. How many will die? You're the pivotal generation. Because if your generation gets wiped out as a result of the promiscuity, the failure to obey God, the generations that follow you will learn the lesson. But it's your generation that I'm concerned about. You're the ones that are in the crux. You're the one that's in the crossfire of what's happening. Please listen to God. Please listen to God. Follow Joseph's example. You can do it. And it can be very, very hard sometimes. You might even have to run. And it happened, he steered clear of it. Notice in verse 11, it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house were inside. She had dismissed them all. That she caught him by the garment and said, "Lie with me." He grabs his robe. Oh man, Lord, you said that no temptation would overtake me except that which is common to man, and that you'll be faithful, that with the temptation you'll provide a way of escape. What am I going to do? She's got my robe. Leave your robe. Leave your Nikes. Leave your hat. Leave anything you have to leave. Just don't leave your character in that bed. Don't let them take that. Leave whatever you've got to leave. Give that to someone to whom it'll be special. And so he takes, so it was when she saw, and he takes, she says, "Lie," and he left the garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. That's the greatest thing. Just run. Run and then do 100 push-ups and then, run and then swim and take cold showers and do sit-ups and do whatever you've got to do to get away from that. And so it was when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside, she was very, very upset. This is known as a woman scorned, and we will pick that up next week.